Welcome to everyone. This is March 27, 2014. It's the Ontology Summit 2014, Session 11, Track D, Tackling the Variety Problem in Big Data, Part 2. I'll be chairing this. The Track D co-champions are myself and Ann Thessen. So if you go to slide 2 of the introductory slides, you'll see the session outline. I'll be giving an introduction. Then Anatoly Levenchuk will be giving a brief announcement about the hackathon. And then we'll begin with our speakers, Mark Fox, Malcolm Chisholm, Dan Brickley, and Rosario Seda Sosa. We will try to keep these short enough so that we can have a nice panel discussion for about 20 minutes at the end. So going to slide 3, this is a continuation of the first session on the variety problem of big data. So this is just a reminder that there are three main aspects of big data: large amounts, rapid pace, and complexity. And we're going to be dealing mainly with the issue of very complex data sources. There are a number of ways that ontologies can help. Looking at slide 4, here are some suggestions that we've gotten already. I won't go over those again, because today, slide 5, we're going to be looking at some still more opportunities for ontologies to help, namely data governance, data integration, and quite a variety of techniques that Dan Brickley will be talking about: schema.org, FOF, and linked data. So if you go to slide 6, the speakers today will begin with Mark Fox from the University of Toronto, who will be talking about the problem of data generated by cities. Cities are, of course, an enormous resource for data, since more than half the world's population lives in cities, and there are, in fact, quite a lot of cities. So the variety problem for this is really quite daunting. Then we're going to go on to Malcolm Chisholm, who will talk about data governance. This is basically the governance of data all over enterprises, and of course would also be true for data in more public contexts. And he'll discuss what's involved in data governance and its implications for managing the variety problem in big data. Then slide 7. Dan Brickley is going to be examining the variety problem on the web, and will be giving us an overview of lessons that he's learned from schema.org, FOF, and linked data deployment. And so this should be quite an interesting talk, because he has been in the trenches for some time now and should have a lot of experience to share with us. And then we'll end with Rosario Seda Sosa from IBM, who will continue the examination of the variety problem for city data, along with some possible solutions to these problems. So let's move on to Anatoly.
Yeah, and I have a very short speak about our hackathon. This hackathon is already March 29. This is Saturday. This Saturday. And we will have fun in nearest 3 days. And you should remember that we try to address three gaps. Please, slide 2. Structured data gap, hybrid reasoning gap, and schema reusability gap. And most of our projects try to fit at least one gap, and several of it have touched two gaps. And next, please, slide 3. Work plan. We will have hackathon 24-hour all over the globe this Saturday. After this, 3rd of April, we will have short report about what happened this Saturday. And after this, we will have a long report and maybe demonstration at this year's symposium. And next slide, 4. You see that most of the teams have already their local time start and communications means. Reference data for anime and manga, semantic linking and publishing of diverse data sets. I expect this is very special hackathon. Maybe most of the communications will be in Russian, but it seems to me any English speakers welcome. It will be interesting for everybody, and this will be a special virtual event because half of the team will be in Moscow in person in office, and several people I know from Berlin, from Zurich, and several other places. One from Minsk, and this will be many different people, many different sub-projects, and you are welcome. They will be modeling, it seems to me, staff positions in anime studios. Very narrow topic, and very not too much anime and manga, but about professional position modeling. The next, ontology design patterns and semantic abstractions in ontology integration. And this is go-to meeting. And how to get this go-to meeting, please write a letter to Mike Bennett, and you will receive all the instructions. And the same is to every other hackathon members, because if you can join in previous hackathon to Mikoga session, the number is the number they have of this session, code of Mikoga session. But about other means, please see the pages of their respective projects, because most fresh information will be hourly, maybe twice a day, maybe at least once a day, but will be updated on their respective project roster pages. Every project have a page with very fresh information, and you can see all the projects now. The next, optimize Sparkle performance management via native API. It will via Google Hangout, and please consult with Viktor Chernov in mail how to have this Google Hangout session. It will be very interesting. It seems to me they will try to show that Nitro Base is at least 10 times and maybe 100 times more speedier in 100 million triples than several other triple stores. And next, 7th slide, anti-hub consolidation. And please consult with Till Masakovsky and Oliver Katz what to do to join them. It seems to me this is a long-term project, and many people familiar with them, and it will be a constant refactoring project, and this will be a major step in this refactoring. It is multi-year activity, and many people interested in this project, as I know. The next 8, semantic annotation of the ontolog community environment. And this is ontolog conference bridge and SOAP hub. The communications means the same that you using now in session. And don't miss it. It will be very interesting, and it can be a huge amount of people participating. Please join them. And then the sixth is ontological catalog of ontology and metadata vocabulary characteristics relevant to suitability for semantic web and big data applications. Communications, Google Hangout, the same thing. Amanda Wisdom, please consult with her what to do. And this is continuation of ontology of ontology topic of last year. This is variation for this year and will be very interesting. And already Amanda have a big team. See her page, what happening there. The next 10th page, what next? Next, we will have not maybe so synchronous communication, but all the hackathon communications during this day will be asynchronous via our ontology discussion list, ontology summit discussion list. And I will be available to try to cope with all the projects and with the help of Ken Baklavsky and Dan Brickley. And please ask us if you have some problems, because we three people cover all the 24 hour around the globe. Dan Brickley will be in Europe. Anatoly Levinchuk, this is Europe, Moscow. This is 4 hours from Europe to the east. And Ken Baklavsky will be covering this from United States. And if you have questions, ask freely in personal communication or in letters to discussion list. We will be monitoring this all this day and before it. Thank you. See you 29th of March this Saturday. Have fun.
Thank you, Anatoly. So now let's move to Mark Fox, the first speaker. Mark?
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to talk about big data from a city's perspective. As we're all probably aware, big data is like an elephant. There are many different types depending upon the nature of the problems that you're working on. I'm going to come at it from, as I said, a city's perspective. And as Ken mentioned earlier, the majority of the world's population lives in cities. It's estimated by 2050 that 80% of the population will live in cities. And so it behooves us to figure out how to manage cities better than we are today. Let me start off my presentation by talking about the poster child, slide number 2. The poster child of big data city-related applications. This is one that was a project headed up by Michael Flowers at the City of New York. The issue was that building owners were converting their buildings into illegal rooming houses containing 10 times the number of people that they were designed for. And the city has inspectors that they send out on a regular basis. There's about 200, and they receive over 25,000 complaints about illegal conversions from residents of the city. But the inspectors have to cover over 900,000 properties across the city of New York. And the reason why this is an issue is that these illegal conversions become fire hazards, sources of drugs, crime, disease, pest infestations, etc. And just to bring it home for us in Toronto, a week ago today, there was a small three-story house in Kensington Market where the second and third floor was converted into a rooming house, and there was a fire. And when the fire department arrived, they found approximately 20 people living in this small space on the second and third floor. And in the end, there was 2 people dead and about 10 others who were injured in this relatively small rooming house. So it is a major, major issue. And so what the city set out, what Flowers and his team set out to do, was to figure out if big data could be used to help the inspectors in ranking the different illegal conversion complaints that they receive on a daily basis, so that rather than sending them out in only 13% of the time are these inspections resulting in a vacant order, can they increase the percentage of vacant orders by focusing their inspections on buildings that truly that the probability of them having an illegal conversion is quite high. And so that was ultimately the goal. Slide number three, please. And so the big data team at the City of New York got together and started thinking through what types of data one could use to figure out how to rank which complaints to focus on. And they got data from about 19 different agencies across the City of New York, which includes data from building preservations, police, fire, tax, et cetera. But they also incorporated their own expertise, and that is knowing that buildings that were recently issued building permits are probably buildings where the owner's taking care of them and less likely to have an illegal conversion. Also, buildings that have a large number of police reports is a negative indicator in the sense that an illegal conversion is more highly likely. After spending about 15 months working on this data, they came up with a system that ranked the complaints that they received. And they went from 13% to 70% of the buildings that they inspected actually resulting in a vacate order. And so it had a huge impact on the City of Toronto, and it's their poster child. Everybody points to that particular application as a very good example of big data. Let's go to slide number four. But from a city's perspective, from a big data perspective, you got to ask the question, how big is big? And the bottom line is most of the city-related applications that I'm running into, the data isn't big. We're talking megabytes, maybe gigabytes. We're not talking the huge data sizes that we're seeing in what you would normally think of as big data, where you need techniques like MapReduce, Hadoop, et cetera. And what's happening is that the organizations we're dealing with are making a conversion from doing gut-based decision-making to fact-based decision-making. And frankly, any facts will do because there's not a whole lot of data that is available or useful for making those decisions. And so really when people are talking about big data within the city context, they're talking about data analytics, and the data isn't all that large. But there's a separate set of issues that arise in this big data or data analytics that are particularly troublesome. And the real bottleneck that we run into with respect to the types of city problems that I've been looking at is what data do we need, okay? And figuring out what data you need often requires some degree of research into the problem you're trying to solve, the literature, the theories that have been generated, et cetera. And even if you identify a large number amount of attributes that you want, you can't simply dump it into a data mining tool. For example, within the province of Ontario, we have municipality financial information that we get from all 400 and some odd municipalities. The number of attributes that we have run on the number on the order of 150 to 200 financial attributes that are reported on an annual basis. And if you just dump them into a rapid miner or something like that, it sort of comes back and says, I can't figure out what to do with this. And so you're faced with the issue of what are these attributes? What do they mean? When I'm merging multiple data sets, are these equivalent attributes? And then ultimately, is the data correct? Is it complete? And the big issue that we run into is, even though data is reported under certain attributes, even though the attributes have been standardized across all the municipalities in the province of Ontario, the actual task of putting numbers to those attributes by each of the municipalities is done differently, and that the interpretation of the attributes can be entirely different from one municipality to another, and hence the actual numbers are not comparable because how those numbers were derived were entirely different. And so if I go to slide number six, the key distinction that we're running into in the types of big data we're doing or data analytics we're doing with cities is that in our mind there's a distinction between data and information. And for us, the notion of data is a set of values that are created by a repeatable, standardized, calibrated process. That is, when it says the temperature is 20 degrees centigrade or Fahrenheit or whatever, it's 20 degrees centigrade or Fahrenheit, okay? But the information that, and what I'd like to refer to as the information that we receive as opposed to the data, is a set of values that are created by a process that is inherently uncertain. And hence, the values of the attributes and the interpretation of the attributes themselves are uncertain, okay? And yet, whether you're determining the number of homeless people or the municipal financing data that I reported, you're not really sure that the data represents what you think it represents. And that poses a huge challenge for us. Okay, so let me go to slide number 7, because what I want to do is I want to focus on the work that we have been doing over the last year or so in the area called Global City Indicators. And a Global City Indicator is a metric, a measurement of some aspect of a city's performance. And we have been looking at Global City Indicators from the perspective of, can we actually analyze cities using these indicators? Now, let's go back in time to about 2005, 2006. Slide number 8, please. The World Bank funded a study at the University of Toronto of city performance indicators at 9 cities in North and South America. And as you can see, Brazil, Colombia, United States, Canada, cities from those countries were covered. And the goal of the study was to find out what the indicators were they're using and whether there's some degree of commonality amongst those indicators. So if we go to slide number 9, what came out of that study was there's a total of 1,100 indicators being used across the 9 pilot cities, and only 2 were comparable. And that was a shock, that only 2 were comparable. So if we go to slide number 10, out of that analysis came a report by the World Bank basically saying, we got to change how we measure cities. We think we are measuring cities, when in fact we have nothing that we can use to be able to compare cities against each other. And that's one of the goals of the World Bank, is to do these types of comparisons, to identify what cities need help, which ones don't need help, which ones can be a clear leader and provide guidance to the other cities. And so they came up with a set of requirements for what these indicators should be. Objective, well-defined, precise, unambiguous, simple to understand, measurable and replicable, easily quantified, systematically observed, auditable, valid, subject to third-party verifications, and it goes on and on. You can read that. But to me, when I read that set of requirements, it sort of read like why it is we build ontologies. Okay, and so it became clear to me that the whole city indicator area was ripe for the application of ontologies. Now, out of that initial study at the University of Toronto, they created what was called the Global Cities Institute. And the Global Cities Institute's initial mandate was to define a standard set of indicators that can be used globally around the world. And so the indicators is about 125 at this particular time. Have been defined to cover education, finance, governance, et cetera, city services and quality of life. And there are over 250 cities around the world. And I believe that China just signed up, over 100 cities in China have just signed up to participate in this, to create a standard set of indicators that can be used across the world. Now, slide number 12, when they started out, the initial definitions of the indicators were as follows. In 2008, the definition of one education indicator called student-teacher ratio was student-teacher ratio, not very insightful. By 2012, it got a whole lot better. A student-teacher ratio was defined as having a numerator called number of students and denominator defined as number of teachers, okay? From my perspective, laughable from the Global City Institute wasn't so, they weren't too happy about me laughing when I saw it. But by 2014, slide number 13, please, the definitions of the indicators became a whole lot more interesting. First bullet, the ratio expresses the number of enrolled primary schools, so we now have primary school as opposed to any school, divided by full-time equivalent primary school teachers, that's a denominator, this is their full-time. Third bullet, private education facilities are not included. Fourth bullet, part-time students will be counted as full-time. Fifth bullet, full-time equivalents, where two half-day students equal to one full will be noted. Next bullet, number of classroom teachers and other instructional staff shall not include administrators and non-teaching staff. And it goes on and on what what you see on slide number 13 is the exact definition. Okay. There's nothing more. There's nothing less than what you see there. And for the 125 or so indicators, you see comparable levels of definition. And so as a result of that, if I go to slide number 14, we're now in a situation where these indicators have been submitted to ISO, as a standard, and it was accepted, I think, last week as a standard, ISO 37120, by the ISO organization, and is being worked on at over 350 cities around the world as a basis of doing measures of those cities. Now, there's a problem. Those indicators are defined using English. Okay, they're not defined in any ontology or vocabulary that's computer-based. And much of the, if we go to slide number 15, much of the work in some of the computer science departments, I'm being slightly provocative here, has focused on visualization. Could be a radar chart or whatever, to allow people to see how they sit relative to other cities. What we're trying to do here in the Global Cities Institute is to make the transition from visualization to analysis, and more particularly to automate the analysis of city performance so that given the appropriate representation of data, we can figure out why a city is performing the way it's performing. Okay? If you go to slide number 17, the two types of analyses that we're looking at is longitudinal analysis, where you compare a city against itself over time. And for those of you who are familiar with Toronto in 1990, around 1998, we merged a number of the outlying cities into a single city. So Toronto in 2010 is very different than Toronto in 1990. And we also want to do transversal analysis where we're comparing one city against another, as you can see, let's say against Chicago in 2010. And the big question is, why are they different? Now, in order to automate the analysis, slide number 18, in order to automate the analysis, we first have to have a representation. That's where ontologies come in. And the problem is when we first started looking at it, there was a modeling gap, slide number 19. And the modeling gap was that all we had in our database, all that was being reported, was just a number associated with an attribute. We had no idea what the unit of measurements were, whether it's ratio, ordinal, or nominal. We have some of that from the text, but not in the actual representation online. We had no notion of scale, whether they were reporting in DESA, DEC, or whatever. If we go to slide number 20, there was no definition online of what a student-teacher ratio was, strictly in text. What is a student-teacher ratio? Is it a division? Does it have a numerator? Is it a denominator? Is it a number that's a result of the division, ordinal, what's the units, etc.? If you go to slide number 21, if you're dividing the number of students by the number of teachers, what's the number of students? Is it a statistic? Is it a set that you're counting? If either of those, what's the population that we're drawing upon? How do we represent that? Slide number 22. If we have something like a student population that we are counting, okay, what's the definition of the students within the population? What's the definition of the area that it's drawn from? Are we talking about drawing a student population from Toronto, Ontario, or Toronto, Ohio? Do we have a way of representing that? And on slide number 23, what's the definition of a student? Full-time, part-time, regular, special, primary, secondary? Because if we don't know that and we're comparing Dubai against Chicago, they may have very different definitions. Even though the standard says the way you're supposed to do this, it says the way you're supposed to do it, doesn't necessarily mean they're actually doing it in that particular way. And then on top of that,
Mark,
we need our...
One more minute.
Okay. So... we need a definition of student, public, private, et cetera. We also need slide number 25. We also need a representation of provenance, who created it, when, how, the validity, the effective time period over which this data is valid or not, degrees of belief and trust in the organizations and the people who actually provide it. And so the consequence of this, slide number 26, is that in order to represent a single indicator, there is a large basis of foundational ontologies that have to be identified and merged, integrated, in order to represent that single indicator. And if I go to slide number 27, as you move the indicators out beyond education into government, economy, et cetera, you'll see on the column titles things such as government, finance, economics, census, environment, et cetera. There are a variety of applied ontologies that have to be identified and integrated into this in order to do it well. Step number two, once we actually have a representation, the next question is, as we bring data in from over the semantic web, is the data consistent with our expectations? Is it consistent with the definitions of the indicators? Is the data consistent with each other? And that leads to consistency related to, are we measuring the same cities, which is slide number 29. Are we using the same metrics, measurement theory, the units of measure, et cetera? That's slide number 30. Are we measuring the same population? Are we defining teacher the same? Slide number 31, et cetera. Slide number 32, there are rules that deal with validity, prominence, and trust in terms of consistency. And then slide number 33, the next step after we have all the consistency rules for when we integrate all the data is we can then start analyzing the data to determine why changes occur. I'm not going to cover step number three because that's where we're focusing our attention now, but simply go to the conclusion, slide number 34. The bottom line is the nature of the data that we use for our, quote, big data analysis or data analytics it has a high degree of uncertainty embedded in it. And that then requires that our representation have a high degree of fidelity, that it be very good at representing what the data was really created out of. And in order to achieve that degree of fidelity, we need a semantically rich core of both foundational and applied ontologies. And the sad thing is, most of the ontologies that we search for, that we look for to use as a basis of what we're doing, tend to be just vocabularies without any definitions, without any COMC questions defining what they were originally designed for. But luckily, there are some ontologies, and you'll see in the references, some of the ones that we're using for measurement theory, time, trust, provenance, validity, that can be used as a basis. And so without these more formal ontologies, without the more formal definitions of these ontologies, the type of work that we're doing now would not be possible. And that's it.
Thank you very much. That was really quite insightful. Certainly going to be the basis of a lot of discussions. Okay, so now we're moving on to Malcolm Chisholm.
So, thank you. If we can start with slide number one. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak to the Ontology Summit today. My interest has been for some time, one of my interests has been for some time, data governance, and I've had the opportunity to do one large project in which this has been applied to big data. And so we'll be talking a little bit about some really from my experience in that today. So can we advance to slide number two, please? In that, we will be looking at what is data governance, governing the structure of columnar databases, source, onboarding, and ingestion. Information requirements are critical, a response to information requirements, and then an idea or a personal viewpoint on the scope of semantics for governance. So can we advance to slide number three, please? Data governance is relatively new. I first came across the term in 2005. My understanding is that it originated actually in the Walt Disney Company with some of the work that they were doing a few years earlier than that. And it has really grown quite dramatically in the past 9 years, I guess. I think that is indicative of the need for data governance, but we have difficulties in understanding, I think, coherently what it is. It has been variously described as decision rights frameworks or a ways of who decides what we should do with the data. Those kinds of definitions are rather high level and not actionable. And I think one way of looking at it is that data governance has a relationship, or maybe more than one relationship, with data management, where data management is the actual operational processes of doing stuff with the data. So I think data governance will specify the processes, policies, decision frameworks for data management and ensures direction and guidance provided by data governance are followed by data management. But I think that's still a little amorphous. And therefore, I think what we have is that data governance is a collection rather than a single concept. It's a collection of a diverse set of concepts which are all united by the common need to do data management. So some examples of these data governance disciplines would include information knowledge management, which is knowing what data we have, where it is, what it means, who made what decision about it, are there quality problems with it, how can I get it, who do I talk to about it, and so on and so forth. Another one would be legal privacy and compliance. I've got some data here. What can I do with it? Can I combine it with other data? Am I contractually obligated to not do certain things with this data? And can I prove that I'm following these promises which we've made about the data? Then there's principles, policies, and practices, which are really setting frameworks for how we're going to do the data, such as, you know, every database will have a data model, for instance. And then there's issue management, which is we find problems with the data, how are they reported, how are they tracked, and how are they addressed. So those are just a few of the examples of data governance disciplines. I believe there are many more of them. And intimately connected with this is metadata, which has many different meanings. Unfortunately, when I started in this profession, it was kind of thought there was a single fixed set of metadata. Once you knew that, you knew all the types of metadata that were out there. I don't believe that to be the case. I think the metadata is the data that describes all aspects of an enterprise's information assets and enables the enterprise to effectively use and manage these assets. So metadata is intimately connected with data governance. So I think we have some feel for what data governance is. Next slide, number 4, please. So let's jump into a big data problem. So big data is very often, people will use Hadoop environments, HFS, which is a file management system, but we have also columnar databases such as HBase built on that. These have a characteristic structure in terms of how a row is laid out. There's a row ID, there's a column family, per table. This is a column qualifier, a timestamp, and a payload. Well, the column family has to be defined ahead of time when the table is created, and it's full of tags essentially. What do these tags mean? For instance, here's an example: customer, employee, purchase, or maybe hundreds more. What does customer mean? Are these somehow related? Are they part of the same hierarchy? Are they independent, or are there some kind of other association between them? These kinds of databases don't have a system catalog, which we would find in the relational paradigm, and there's no foreign keys. So there's a scope for vastly diverse data within one table. Of course, there's tremendous benefits from these tables in terms of speed of retrieval. But we can easily lose track of what the column family means, and I have found that our friends, the developers, were not adept at keeping documentation about this. So here was a tremendous data governance need to really track this information in a data space that was dedicated to metadata about the columnar databases. The danger, of course, is that if you don't do this, if you do not have this discipline, everybody wants to code and do stuff, you will lose track after a short while of what you have inside your big data, ultra-large-scale data space. Now, the same lessons for column family apply to row ID, column qualifier, timestamp, and especially payload, which itself can have all kinds of structure within it. Can we advance to slide number 5, please? So that's one problem where data governance can have an impact. Another one, which I think is also unique to big data environments, is source onboarding and ingestion. So while we can have big data environments that do process updates and transactions, and there's, I'm sure, you know, we're all aware of examples of environments that do that very well. Typically, for most uses, we're going to ingest data that already exists in from some operational or other system into our ultra-large scale data space, our big data space, which may be in the cloud or elsewhere, and we will, process that. Well, questions. If we're going against a source, where did the source get that data from? How is it generated? What do we know about this source itself in terms of maybe we need a point of contact, maybe we need to know what data quality issues they know about, what they see as constraints, timelinesses, issues, if it's not a one-time load, SLAs about repeated loads, and information like that. That has to be carefully captured because it's really going to affect the operational environment. Again, you know, we just ought to load things up. Secondly, you find daisy chains between sources, and I have talked to a very large data provider who went out and at some expense got data from a variety of sources only to find and try to use this to correlate data quality of that data provider's own data, and the answer came out, wow, our data is of extremely high quality, but the reason was that the sources they chose actually ingested data that the data provider itself had sold to somebody else. So you have these sort of round robins of data or daisy chains of data that do have to be understood. And that's kind of source data analysis at the onboarding stage and ingestion stages is incredibly important. And again, you need this documented, you need it in actionable metadata because it's going to have to be used repeatedly. Other kinds of information you need about your sources, profile information, like what kinds of data? You know, is there a subject area model? That is an upper ontology of the domain of reality which this data purports to represent. And then what are the data formats, of course? Technical metadata, but nevertheless, we want to make sure in data governance that's properly recorded. We don't want repeated source data analysis. What's unique versus duplicated in the data? And again, things like the contact personnel, the SLAs, and the data quality. So again, a vast scope here for data governance to come in to really make the environment work smoothly in terms of the run the business or day-to-day data management, so that we don't have expensive mistakes given the difficulties of ingestion and loading and so on and so forth. These can be quite expensive. Can we advance to slide number 6, please? Next, information requirements are critical. Big data is not like relational data. It has a data storage model, but it doesn't have the logical data model which tries to mediate between that storage model and the business reality which it purports to represent. Furthermore, we're more often in an environment where the raison d'etre of what we're trying to do is to answer questions. And that's like a data warehouse. And just as with data warehouses, they're kind of, you know, the things are subject-oriented, even more so in a big data environment. So information requirements are critical. A particular interest here is the constraint that, at least in the columnar databases I've worked with, the data is laid out physically in lexicographical order. So this isn't like, again, a relational database where you've got an index that'll just sort of jump around and get rows for you. These are in lexicographical order. If you do not order your big data that way, your queries will not run in an acceptable time frame. This means that there's a great deal of reshaping of data through MapReduce to bring it into a shape that the query that you've got will utilize. Now, so how do we trap the information requirements? That's again the data governance issue, where we need to make sure that these are not just something that are done on the back of napkins that, or, you know, in some highly informal manner, that there's a library of them, they're available, they can be looked at, and it would also give you some reuse as well. And I think we are all aware of, you know, parallel horror stories in the data warehousing world, where we see each report having its own data mart. That's not something we want to repeat here. I don't think we have the luxury to do that. So, again, another area in which data governance can be of immense use. Can we advance to slide number 7, please? This really takes on what I've just said in a bit more of an example of a more detailed example, where inverted indexing, which was one of the responses that we had in my project to the fact you really don't have a relational environment. So how the heck do you deal with all these rather different information requirements about the essentially the same data? And it shows here how really the first table is answering the question of, you know, who shows up in what document. And table number 2 is showing you where did we find out about each person in each document. So I don't need to go into that too much, but it gives you an idea of the increased diversity of, or perhaps complexity, that can arise in these environments. And you can imagine how easily you can get lost, and, you know, especially with staff turnover, the knowledge about how this this all works is going to perhaps not be there, and you don't want to go and do archaeological work to find out kind of what happened, and you will not be able to infer design decisions without the designers being around either, ultimately. So, can we advance to slide number 8, please? And this is the final slide. This is my view of the scope of what is really needed for semantics for governance. Some of this was kind of gone over in Mark Fox's presentation, terms and concepts, and I think keeping those two things distinct and using real, not nominal, definitions is very important. So that we have to get the concepts used in the business really well understood, and bearing in mind that definition is process as well as product. I don't think definitions are just done once and not improved. I think they're continuously improved, like bringing an image into focus. And they're distinct from terms, so that we can have different speech communities who can mediate over different over the same semantic community. The definitions have to be useful. I include business usage facts within definitions as well. Anything that helps you use the concept in a business context should be included in the definition. Taxonomies, generally the relationship of general with specific concepts, probably also part-whole relations, and probably also some certain kinds of associative systems, such as input-output or product finished good. Hierarchies are a little bit more complex. These are, rather than concepts linking together, these are how individual things, instances such as core people, individuals, people, or business entities are related. There's tremendous issues with those in terms of we can have a hierarchy of legal ownership, of control, of risk, for sales, and so on. And this people try to use the wrong hierarchy for a particular business need because they don't understand it. Relationships, the other business relationships outside taxonomies and hierarchies. Business rules, which, again, Mark touched on, very important. Atomic units of logic that govern the behavior of concepts and relationships. There's a whole sub-discipline of business rules governance, which is typically done rather poorly. And then ontologies, as I would call them in practical terms for data governance, these are the views that the business world wants to impose on the data and business information that's required to meet a specific business need. So all these factor into semantics for governance in big data environments, and each one has its own methods, its own challenges, and you know, hopefully we'll see methods that are increasingly more sophisticated and address the challenges evolve over the years to come. And with that, I would like to hand back to, I don't know if it's Ken or Peter, sorry.
Thanks, Malcolm. That was great. So now we'll move on to Dan Brickley.
So do you have slide zero up, title slide? So I'll talk into the vacuum, and I'll try and keep an eye on the chat channel in case it turns out I'm inaudible. So hi, my name's Dan Brickley. I work at Google on structured data standards, in particular on the schema.org project, which is a collaboration between Google and several other search engines, Bing, Yahoo, and Yandex in particular. Before that, I was involved in the RDF work at W3C for a horribly long time. I co-edited the RDF schema spec with Guha, who I also work with on schema.org. I co-chaired the RDF working group, core working group, helped put together various of the more popular RDF vocabularies out there in the early days, so FOF and SCOS, RSS1. The thinking behind today's short talk is to provide a brief overview of the schema.org work and to highlight its approach to various kinds of variety in very, very, very big data, basically in the web. So what does that mean by this wordy title, web scale vocabulary deployment? Schema.org, it's a cross-domain approach to structured data, across the biggest data set around the World Wide Web itself. So I want to start here with an overview of the schema.org approach, for those of you not familiar with it, and then to touch on three different kinds of variety that we encounter in this work. So I'll list those now and then come back to them after the schema.org overview. Checking the chat channel to make sure you can hear me. Okay, firstly, variety in terms of extensibility points. For an initiative working out from a shallow cross-domain schema, what are the attachment points or integration techniques for plugging in richer, independently developed schemas? Secondly, variety in terms of identification in a potentially fragmented, unreconciled entity graph. How can the web deal with several independent parties describing the same real-world entities? And then thirdly, a variety of expressive patterns. That's a fancy way of saying that when we deal with many independent parties and datasets talking about overlapping topics, we will inevitably have different ways of saying the same thing. How can we document such variety in ways that make life easy for non-ontology everyday publishers and webmasters, developers? So what kind of validation and other tooling help there? Advance to slide two, please. Okay, so assuming slide two, let me open by showing you some of the most basic schema.org markup. And I have to say this is kind of embarrassingly simple, especially for a professional ontology audience. But I hope you'll appreciate that this is an interesting way to sneak up on some of the harder data sharing problems that are out there. So the most basic use of schema.org is just as simple as this. What do we got? There's a movie with a name, Pirates of the Caribbean. It's got a description. It might have actors and so on. We, schema.org, can provide schemas or vocabularies, ontologies, whatever you want to call them, that provide types such as movie and properties like name, description, actor. At this time, there are just over 1,000 terms defined in schema.org, mostly types and properties, a few small enumerations, growing in variety and in depth on a monthly basis. the concrete markup options we use for sharing this data, or we encourage people to use for sharing this data, include microdata, shown here, alongside RDFA, JSON-LD, or any RDF syntax you like as well. The most interesting thing about schema.org is that it's being used, that it's having substantial impact in the mainstream web. So ISWC last year, Google gave out some high-level numbers, most briefly that we're seeing schema.org data on over 5 million internet domains. Advance to slide 3, please. That's the one with the screenshot of schema.org. So how did this come about? Why would 5 million sites care to publish billions of simple RDF descriptions after all these years of RDF seeing relatively slow adoption? What is schema.org? Schema.org is a collaboration between several internet search engines, Bing, Yahoo, Yandex, and Google. And I think this engagement from mainstream internet services is both the source of schema.org's success and of our variety problem, the kind of problems we're facing from having data from the entire web thrown at us. So let me first just say a few words about how Google has been using schema.org data to indicate the kind of real-world scenarios the data is used in. Firstly, so-called rich snippets. So this has been the largest long-term cause of adoption. Essentially, it's about the search engine results page formatting. Instead of a dull list of blue links, in certain cases, pieces of structured information from the matched page are lifted out into the search results to give a richer summary in a user-facing way. So maybe recipes or organizations or music show up with details of those entities in the search results. This may seem super basic compared to some of the fantasy scenarios that were circulated in the early days of the semantic web, intelligent agents and so on, but it has the advantage of providing concrete value to millions of users and millions of publishers. So beyond rich snippets, you can also find schema.org usage with various other Google products and services. So for example, Gmail can detect schema.org descriptions within your email messages, and it can use this to help make your inbox more actionable or to give you relevant notifications. For example, a map to a restaurant booking showing on your phone just when you need it. So again, that provides both concrete value to publishers, developers, and users. But I think importantly, schema.org is merely a useful supporting technology rather than the star of the show. And I think in the early days of RDF, people sort of wanted this idea of end users exploring RDF data or using an RDF or linked data browser. And I think schema.org is super important, but it's super low-key. It's just a piece of the puzzle, a little bit of background technology that users don't see. Advance to slide 4, please. So this should be the company logos. Okay, so naturally I know Google's usage the best because I work there, but I really want to emphasize that schema.org is a collective effort. So most foundationally, it's a collaboration amongst Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and Yandex for the good of their users and for the good of the web. It's also been a large collaboration with many semantic web link data experts who discuss expansion of the schemas via a public mailing list that we maintain over at W3C. Advance to slide 5, please. So that should be the wider community. So I've listed here some of the more formal organization-based collaborations that have informed the growth of schema.org. So since launch, we've improved coverage of news topics with collaboration with the IPTC, e-commerce markup, teaming up with Martin Hepstead relations work, dataset description, integrating and design developed mostly at W3C, learning resources, so the LRMI project, alongside the Association of Educational Publishers and the Creative Commons. And fairly recently also improved our modeling of TV and radio broadcast, collaborating with friends at the European Broadcasting Union and at the BBC. So beyond these more project-like collaborations, there's also dozens of individual interactions over at W3C on the Public Web Schemas group mailing list. So I wanted to list those because that's really the essence of the variety that we face, that there's all these different topics. They're all very natural and organic and user-facing, and they overlap horribly. So let's take a deeper look. Advance to slide 6, please. So this should give you just a couple of views into the hierarchy. Nothing too unexpected here. The thing at the top of the hierarchy, there's creative work, event, organization, person, various kinds of place. You get the picture. Advance to slide 7, please. So that should give you an overview of all of our types. Just check the chat log. Can you still hear me okay? I'm going to go with yes. Excellent. Okay. Let's go through the types quickly. So advance to slide 8. You'll see 8 and 9 and 10 and 11. Keep going through the slides until you get to the wiki table. Basically, I wanted to show the good relations markup, where that sits in the hierarchy, RNews, LRMI Health. When you're lucky, these things are in a separate tree, and they don't touch on any of the other parts of the tree. But in practice, they all touch on common themes. So settling down slide 12, the vocabulary pipeline. This is just a wiki page over at W3C, where we keep track of the various proposals bubbling under for extending schema.org. So in here, you can see top of the list at the moment, Citation, which was a proposal from the BibExtend group. This is a subgroup focused on bibliographic markup. Accessibility, actions, orders, email message. This is kind of the grunt work of growing out schema.org. Why am I showing you this? What do I want you to take away from this so far? Basically, that we've been incrementally growing out schema.org in several directions fairly opportunistically. We extend the schemas when someone comes up with a simple enough design that helps capture information in real existing today websites. And ideally where there are plenty of such sites, and particularly when publishers of such sites are excited to adopt. So in doing so, there are inevitably a number of overlaps, especially in cross-cutting areas like geo. So we have a place vocabulary. This covers sports-related locations, amongst other things. We've also got a medical and health vocabulary. So how would we link that to a health center, which is simultaneously a place and an organization? We've got a variety of in-progress proposals listed in the wiki for growing out these overlapping areas. And the most simplest coordination technology that we have is a big mailing list where everyone talks. So should the people working on sports proposals think about how their schemas can plug into the description of sports-related places? Or should the people working on TV or cultural heritage or bibliographic structures think about how their work relates to sports-related content or to geographic descriptions? Absolutely yes, but can we put all these guys and girls together in one room or even on one telephone conference? Not very easily. So the approach we've taken at schema.org has been to simultaneously encourage collaboration and public discussion of overlapping topical areas, but also to tolerate some noise and variety in the structure of the schemas, rather than hope idealistically for a grand unifying structure that creates the perfect duplication-free ontology. Advance to slide 13, please. This is comparisons. We've had a hopefully brief overview of schema.org, and to recap, we've got with schema.org about 1,000 terms and growing, deployed on millions of sites, including billions of entity descriptions. We, schema.org, are incrementally integrating dozens of proposals by our public mailing list, making various entirely pragmatic judgment calls as to when to integrate and when to tolerate variety and noise and fragmentation amongst the different topical schemas that we pull in. So what I wanted to do now was offer a few high-level remarks on how the schema.org approach differs or builds on the work earlier in the RDF community. Checking the chat log. Okay. Firstly, vocabulary variety. So as you've seen above here, schema.org as project doesn't hide from the variety of vocabularies needed to describe diverse areas of media or health or geo or sport or bibliography. And where possible, we connect to expert groups that already have vocabularies for these. However, as a huge however, we do try to hide this variety from publishers and from webmasters. So we do this through very shallow and pragmatic integration into a unified set of schemas, an entirely, at this time, flat namespace. So this is a huge cultural shift from classic RDF in the semantic web community around W3C. So in that community, which is sometimes its own worst enemy, although I love it dearly, in the W3C semantic web scene, somehow the ability for instance data records to draw on 10 or 20 different vocabularies, somehow it got elevated from an interesting feature to a kind of religious principle. And that's a principle the schema that all goes backed away from. We've said instead, we'll mush it all into one big schema. We'll keep the provenance trail connecting back to the independently managed schemas. But we'll make it as usable as possible by mainstream publishers. So we work very hard to hide variety in the vocabulary sense. Secondly, identification. So classic RDF leads that followed Tim Berners-Lee's 2006 design note took passionately to the idea that every RDF description will make careful and principled distinctions between identifiers for documents and identifiers for the things that those documents talk about, identifiers for real-world entities. Further, that the identifiers for the latter could be derived in various ways from those for the former. So, yeah, my homepage versus me. Schema.org again steps back a little from such optimism while providing ways to reconcile descriptions with well-known identifiers. Thirdly, in terms of varieties, variety or diversity of publishers. So even given the broad adoption and acceptance of linked data RDF publishing techniques that we've seen in recent years amongst public sector organizations, Schema.org is at quite another level of adoption. So the sheer variety of organizations, tools, data sets, etc., that are involved, again, 5 million sites, that injects quite a lot of noise and challenge into the Schema.org world and community. And so by contrast, I feel like, speaking personally, I'm probably one or two degrees of separation from most publishers of RDF data in the 2006 sense. And this difference makes for a quite different set of constraints and trade-offs as we grow out Schema.org. Advance to slide 14, please. So this should be extensibility points for cross-domain.
We've added two more minutes.
Okay, super quick. Schema.org provides a... Schema.org is rather shallow, so how can we go deeper and get richer, more interesting and actionable descriptions of real-world situations? So unfortunately, I don't have time here to sketch the problem, I only have time for sketching the problem, not the solution, but a piece of an answer. Firstly, although we don't shout about it to webmasters, Schema.org shares a data model with W3C RDF and can be seen as an RDF vocabulary. This allows it to be mixed off the shelf with other RDF vocabularies, particularly when using more RDF-friendly notations like RDFA Lite or JSON-LD. Secondly, we've been working on mechanisms for so-called external enumerations of property values from external organizations and publishers. So, for example, in Schema.org, we have a type, place of worship, which offers a few indicative subtypes. The Schema.org collaboration explicitly does not want to get into the business of listing all the religions in the world. So we've been looking at mechanisms for handing this stuff off to data sets like Wikidata from Wikipedia or Freebase or United Nations or Open Government Data. Advance to slide 15, please, and I'll wrap up. You know what, I'm going to skip slide 15 and go to slide 16. So idioms and patterns. This is a somewhat slippery idea, but ties into deeper foundational problems around dizzying complexity of common sense reasoning. So in short, given any real-world situation of interest, even if it's kind of boring and everyday, there are always several plausible ways of describing the entities involved and their properties, different variety of expressive possibilities, if you like. So in terms of documenting structures for a project like Schema.org to handle this expressivity, it means that we sometimes feel the pain of having a documentation structure that's based at the type and property level. Our approach to that has been pretty simple so far. Include lots of examples. At this point, I suspect I'm running out of time. If I can just summarize the current challenges that we're facing. So, super briefly, number one is roles. Yesterday on the public vocabs list at W3C, we circulated a design for squeezing some extra expressivity into RDF in a way that is webmaster friendly. Secondly, actions I mentioned earlier, ways of attaching information about how to make things happen in the real world associated with all the entities that have schema.org descriptions. And thirdly, I think the big interesting area is data sets. Today, W3C just published the CSV on the web work, early use cases for linking rich RDF descriptions to tabular data in CSV form. I think at that point I should hand back the microphone.
Thanks so much. That's quite something that's going on there on pima.org. So, actually going back to the issue of cities, Rosario?
Yes. So I'm going to complement the point of view of the speakers prior, And in slide number two, you know, when I was asked to talk about, you know, big data and variety, well, there were a bunch of thoughts, and you know, they were not forming a cogent history. I've been working on ontologies and models for a number of years, and I've been working in finance, fields like finance and smarter cities, and you know, the medical domain, for example, for the past 4 or 5 years. But you know, I have sort of like a 10-12 year experience in models, in general models. So I'd like to ask three questions. Like, first of all, you know, how do people already store data? And I would like to complement the point of view of the previous speakers. When we talk about smarter cities, well, there's the inescapable fact that cities already are working. They already manage data. So does the finance industry. So does the medical industry. So somehow, albeit imperfect, these domains are already working with data, and they manage to managing to evolve. So how can we capture what is good about this data? How can we work ontologies into this ecosystem of publishers and consumers of data, and how can ontologies ease and be kind of this layer that help us organize the data with various levels of precision? I mean, it's I don't believe, and I think somebody else pointed out earlier, that there's going to be a unique, immutable definition for a term. Terms are likely to evolve, and just the fact that different people will look at the same concepts from different perspectives means that the context and definition of these terms are going to be slightly different, right? So, as I said, I will be trying to answer or at least give you some thoughts on storing data, what information is being stored in some of the domains, like in this particular example, smart cities. What about the information ecosystems? What is needed to create these kind of layers on top of the data that people are already using, not necessarily having a semantic layer subsume all the data of the cities, because I don't think that's very realistic at this stage. And, you know, what does it mean to have really usable, scalable semantics? And what is the role of this technology in the in the ecosystem of producers, that is the publishers and the consumers. So in slide number three, I'd like to kind of have a little historical point. It's something that I really didn't know. I wasn't even born at that time. But in 1962, the first the first attempts to organize data, even before relational database management systems, was actually something called CODASIL, which was a graph. And there were several problems associated with using graphs in storing data. One of them was the variability of the data, the difficulty in indexing and retrieving that information in a fast manner. Of course, you know, as computers have evolved and, you know, we've gotten faster, more efficient computers and, you know, better algorithms and better caching and so on, and we understand database management a lot better, some of these issues have actually propelled the coming of age of these of linked data technology. So we've gotten back to graphs. But once we start thinking about really, really large data, we got to ask ourselves if some of those problems that were foreseen in the 60s with CODASIL and several other artificial intelligence and graph management systems are going to be appearing again, just because of the sheer volume of data. Are there hybrid models that we need to think about in order to get the data that people are already using into a semantic, more related and contextual setting. So in slide number four, I'm kind of honing this point. The notion that when we have the network is an abstraction, and you have data of many different formats connected through inferred navigational relations. And what that means is that there is a there's problems at different layers. One of the layers is the vocabulary. And I think I'm kind of trying to summarize what the prior speakers have been talking about. There is the issue of vocabulary and calling oranges oranges and apples apples, and that is one of the main most important and most basic issues in metadata. And these are issues that are being brought on in areas like finance, for example, with Basel III. So is the ability of having a unique identifier, understanding what is the identity of an entity in the graph, and then, of course, understanding the context. Where does this information appear? What data properties that information has? What are the relations? And that is something that depends. Complex contexts depend actually on the domain, on the perspective. So what I'm trying to say here is that there is a place, and there's a very important place for a standardization and a unification of the data for having very precise semantics. But overall, when we're dealing with large, vast amounts of data that are produced for different purposes, and we're trying to, bring them all together, we may have to play in a gray area, right? So in slide number five, we did a study a couple of years ago of open data in smarter cities. As Professor Fox pointed out, smart cities or cities, the open catalogs in cities is a really a very rich domain for people interested in semantic technologies, because the domain experts are publishing that publishing their information, something that is very, very hard to obtain, for example, in finance. So this is one of the few domains where there is vast amounts of data about very complex entities like cities that people are publishing and putting in the open. Now, it is true that sometimes they're doing the very basic job of just putting their files out there. They're really not really curating their data sources. They're not documenting their metadata, but at least is out there, right? And so we went through 900 data sources, mostly from Washington, D.C. and London for local governments. And then we also looked at national governments like Kenya and India. And we tried to figure out, what kind of data they're talking about, right? And this is an oversimplification. And thanks to Professor Fox, I can really kind of wave my hands and wave a kind of a wand and say, well, we're not going to talk a lot about measurements. But essentially, you have two types of information. People are publishing instance information, that is things that are happening, events that are happening, information very specific about a department. This is just descriptive information. And then they're posting indicators, their statistics. They are, somehow crunching the data and publishing the results and publishing reports. Of these two types, when you look at the instances, you see that they have what you would expect. And I have on the right-hand side some of the examples. You have the entity types, and these are, again, somebody else pointed out, there are no descriptions for those. I mean, if somebody says, okay, well, this is going to be a business license, like, for example, London Data Store has a lot of information about business licenses, well, it's assumed that everybody knows more or less what it is, or a liquor license. It's a type of business license. So the context is pretty much put here by the user, but it's definitely the case that we could use metadata, if anything else, at the textual level to add value through semantics. Then you have your identifiers, and I list there a bunch of examples. Geospatial information, which of course is very important in smarter cities. You have the points, areas, routes, and routes could be, you know, static like a road or dynamic like a bus route, for example. You have time, you know, timestamps, you know, garbage collection in this neighborhood happens every Thursday between the hours of 9 and 11, so some type of time descriptor. You have the domain-specific finite categories, like, for example, if you have a, you know, emergency call, well, what is the status of that call? Has it been resolved? Is pending? So these are enum types which are very, very much domain specific, and actually they're very hard to, you know, to standardize. You have your text, which are descriptions and comments, and then measurements. And measurements could be like the building dimensions. And I, you know, I have kind of a gray area there because when you talk about air quality index, well, that's, or things like vehicles per hour, that could be understood to be kind of a very simple, stat, some very simple processing. And then, of course, you have your indicators where you're not putting out information about a specific event, a specific bus route. You're saying, for example, that all the bus routes in March have been, you know, maybe within 10 points, 10% late, between 0% on time and 10% late. Okay, so that's kind of the information. I mean, we look at 900 of these resources, and we came up with categories. I mean, you know, granted, they are very simplified, but this is pretty much the data that they're posting. And if you're looking at enterprise information, it's going to be very similar. If you look at transaction information for derivatives and futures, it's also very similar, right? It's only when you go to social networks or you go to blogs that you have a lot of unstructured data, and that's when, you know, but it could be argued that you could process all this information and put it into one of these categories. So at least, yeah, it's not a formal ontology, it's not, but at least you know, well, they're talking about time, they're talking about space. Well, maybe there's a way of semantically correlate these events that are happening in this neighborhood with these other guys that are posting parties and so on, and it looks like, you know, their coordinates or their location descriptors are pretty much the same. And again, we're looking to have semantics thrown on top of the data that people already use. So in slide number 6, I'm saying that there is a lot of open data, that some of these data sources, like, for example, Washington, D.C., we use it a lot because it has a lot of information and metadata, even if it's textual, but it is not really linked data. It is, you see, for example, that tables for 311 calls and 911 calls are very similar, but they're not connected. Why? Because the burden is usually put in the consumer of the information. What happens here is there is this ecosystem of people publishing the data, people consuming the data, and people trying to extract value or insight, and pretty much the same thing, from that data. And what we're seeing is actually that some cities that started publishing data in RDF, for example, are reverting to things like JSON-DL or JSON, you know, straight lists, right? So what happens is we're seeing that it is the people that drive the insight into the data, the ones that are motivated to add the semantics. We were expecting most of these cities to start publishing their data in RDF in ways that we could consume easily, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. So in slide number 7, being mindful of the time, for this kind of applications, and I equate these applications also to those in finance, which I've been working lately, you know, and I became very interested in all the market information that is available, it's likely that we are going to need to create the databases, or we're going to have to be able to use the databases that are already created for this and use ontologies as metadata management. Right? So the issue is not are we going to get relational database or databases versus linked data, but how do you capture variable, dynamic, and linked schemas instead of where the data is stored? So what I'm trying to do here is rephrase the question and not talk about variation of data, but variation of metadata, because this is where the game is, as far as I can, you know, this is what my experience is telling me, interpreting this metadata and providing the tools to access this metadata, sometimes on demand, because that's what the domain is going to call for. Sometimes, you know, there will be some processing done, like, for example, in the case of these, city data sources. But mostly it's going to be, you know, the management of the metadata, not the instance data. The instance data, I don't believe at this point people are interested in having it in an ontology format. So I see ontologies as management of the management description and querying of the metadata. In slide number 8, the information ecosystems. It's all about metadata. Again, this is the case, you know, that if we can keep flexible schemas that are authoritative, complete, and extensible, we can use them to integrate many data sources at the application level without altering those data sources, without ETL, or without any kind of processing. Create the views, categorizations, and annotations that do not affect the underlying data sources. Again, do not touch data that is already working for people. And most of these data is working, it may not be consistent because they're just thinking about their own particular use, not because they're thinking of the global use of that data, not because the data itself is wrong. Shield applications for where the data is stored and link the data source in these open catalogs. In slide number 9, you know, there's a program here. There's several items that need to be done, but mostly is the ingestion and, you know, capturing that instance data in a way that can be queried through the ontologies, using ontologies as a caching mechanism. And in slide number 10, I have just, I'm just going to tell you what those slides are, and I'm not going to talk about them because we obviously don't have the time. So there's this a scenario that we did, this was, I think, a couple of years ago, of 911 and 311 requests and how you could just, without touching them, ingest them in an ontology and be able to and be able to query them and connect them. And what we did in slide number 11, something called Scribe, which is actually a semantic model, but it's mostly a semantic metadata for data sources in the city. And we are working right now with the city of Barcelona. With the urban ecology, it's an institute dependent on the city of Barcelona, to extend it to urban ecology and capture actually real city data. And you know, we've put there several places. I mean, we understood ontologies as metadata management. We included customizations and extensions. And in slides 13, 14, and 15. There are examples of some of these queries that we could do. These, of course, are Sparkle queries. We've been working on a way so that domain experts can query these ontologies pretty much like they query Google, but adding some kinds of constraints through a navigation pattern. So that kind of sums it up. And, you know, I wouldn't like to take too much time because I'm really eager to get the discussion started. I think there people have been making very, very important points. I think there are different ways when you talk about data and big data and variability is how you're going to use it, how you're going to leverage it. There are deep uses of this data that require very, very specific, very precise and being able to compare indicators like the case of city indicators that Professor Fox was talking about. There's several other users. where all you need to do is, all you want to do is actually put somehow, get the big picture of what information is available in the city, and data publishers are not doing that. So I think it's up to semantics, very light touch semantics, to do that. And I'm kind of interested in knowing what that gray area looks like and how we can advance on it. So that's it. That's my bit.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Great. So now we'll move on to the discussion. So what you should do is click on the hand on the chat room so that we can get people to line up. Oh, good. Now we have Martin.
Okay. My question was about like the part of the term big data which was not that mentioned in the topics today. Like there was a lot of very interesting information about how ontologies were kind of used for metadata management and handling data from different data sources. But I think a big part of big data is also some kind of a statistical procedure or like a machine learning procedure. I was wondering if any of the speakers are aware of any type of practice where ontological metadata is used for statistical analysis. Like the first speaker mentioned the thing called ingestion, when we kind of use to use data from different data sources and we kind of point out what is the semantics, how the data differs from one data source from to another. Well, does anyone use some kind of a statistical practice when we want to analyze the data, that we use the metadata about where the data came from? That's it.
Mark, you had something to say about that, I believe. Do you want to comment on this?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know offhand who is doing research in doing statistical analyses of data to ascertain where the data came from. There is a whole field of data quality where they use a variety of techniques, syntactic and semantic analysis, to identify issues within the data. But I don't know of any of the work. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just I'm not aware of the work that analyzed the data to see where it came from or what the underlying metadata is to it.
Okay, so you mean when for example, we try to integrate data from different cities, and then we kind of know all the semantic connections between data from different cities, we still try to put it in one format before we execute any statistical procedure. For example, I don't know, count the number of buses or anything like that.
Well, I think Rosario was pretty clear on that topic, that they're using Scribe, if I may speak for Rosario, that they're using Scribe as that meta representation in which they integrate various sources of 311 and 911 data into a single representation. We also, within my group, have been creating a separate ontology for representing 311 data, basically the higher level concepts that that data from cities can be integrated in also. So yes, I mean, both Rosario and our approach is similar in that we have this ontology that we can integrate all the source data into.
Yeah. But I would also like to point out that that's one way to go about it. There's another project here in IBM Research. It's called Helix, head by Kavitha Srinivas. She is trying to mine the metadata based on the instance data on the tables. So there's a top-down approach, which is, I think, what Mark and I are working on. And that can be complemented with a bottom-up approach where you mine those implicit or explicit metadata models. So I think there's plenty of Helix literature. This is a project that has been ongoing for 3 years here in research. So if you Google it, you might want to just take a look at it too.
Thank you.
Just to mention one more thing. It's Mark. There are a number of PhD theses being done on mining relationships in data across the web. And so inferring semantic relationships amongst data spread out there is a topic. I don't know if it's a hot topic, but is a topic that a number of people are pursuing.
Okay. I was more talking about whether it is possible to do any type of statistical inference on data which is not integrated, which is federated, not integrated. So you know what is the connection, and like how are you handling the missing data? If you're just, are you throwing away all the parts of the data which do not fit with each other? For example, if you're trying to understand something across the cities, are you just throwing out that data? Are you trying to impute it somehow? Are you not using anything which is not common between all the data sources?
Well, I mean, there are different ways in which that case can appear. Actually, we're dealing right now with a very, very specific case with the city of Barcelona, where it's even simpler. Is data properties that are associated for whatever reason to a different entity, right? The problem is whether the ontology is a validating ontology, that is, you try to get and clean up the data through the ontology, it acts like a sieve, right? And that's where the constraints come in. Or you have the ontology as the descriptive ontology, which are mostly for integration, that all it does is it points to the information where it might exist. So in the case of a scribe, is a descriptive ontology, and all we've done in this case is point to where, you know, duplicates might exist, or, you know, essentially reveal information. So in this case that I was telling you about, the number of residents, for example, is associated to a land lot, not associated to the building in that land lot. And the reason to have that information in the city is for tax purposes. But it turns out that in a land lot, you can have two buildings, right? So let's say that you have a land lot that has, I don't know, 25 residents associated to the land lot, and there are two buildings there. So if you ask for the number of residents per building, then you get a problem. It's because the data was constructed that way. So what Scribe tends to do in this case is point out that if you want to know about this information for a building, the closest you can come to is just look at the land lot. It just points out the relevant information, because we assume that number of residents is something that is associated to buildings. So it's kind of a roundabout way to say, okay, what we're doing is indexing the data, right?
Yeah.
In the other case, you're assuming that, well, there are problems with the data. I mean, real-life data, and anybody that has worked with real-life data, they can tell you it's messy, right? But if you're going to create a validating schema, you're participating in kind of an ETL. And there's a huge amount of literature on that. So it's you know, conceptually, it's pretty much the same.
Okay, but in the Scribe use case, you kind of end up not using the data which does not fit, right?
Yeah, and that's fine. That's an option that you can do. If it doesn't fit, then don't use it, and that's fine. You know, like, for example, in some of these examples, in one of the slides, I have some data where there was no district information associated to some of these 311s. That's fine. You may still want to know what happened in Chicago, but if you want to know what happened in a particular district, then you have to know that there were, like, I don't know, a 10% or a 5% entities that were not labeled. And I think it's not pretty. I'm not particularly happy about it, but, you know, you got to come to terms with the fact that the data has been working, it's been doing its purpose, and you need to leverage it and point out what the issues are.
Hi, it's Mark wanting to respond to that. We run into that problem all the time. And there are and if I may use the word theory, there are various theories for how to plug the holes in the data. If you go back to my slide deck, there's about three slides which have a set of rules that are consistency axioms. And those consistency axioms can be used in two ways. They can verify that certain parts of the data, pieces of the data are consistent, or they can be used to fill in missing data. The problem with filling in missing data is it's a hypothesis that that's what it should be, and it's not absolutely correct. And depending upon the domain, the use of that hypothesis can be problematic. And so we run into it at the very low levels of just missing little pieces of data, like what the unit should be, et cetera. But we also run into a bit higher in that we may be looking for a certain number that a city is to provide us with in somewhere in Africa, and the data may only be available at the country level. And so the question then becomes, do we take certain population data available at the country level and just assume that statistically it's the same at the city level, when in fact it's actually incorrect, because urban versus suburban versus farm areas are totally different in terms of their population characteristics. And so the ability to fill in missing data is an area more of research than it is of simply coming up with a rule that says, we'll just plug in this if we're missing it, or we'll just omit it. Well, we can't omit it because we're trying to do some type of analysis of that city, and we need that data to do it.
Yeah, sure. There are plenty of statistical procedures for planning missing data. I was just wondering if there's any specific for ontology you wear one.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That was really, really helpful.
Actually, Dan had a comment about this also. Dan Ripley?
Okay.
I think you had some interesting point to make there. I think could you elaborate on it a bit?
Okay, so I don't think it's any surprise to say Google does a lot of machine learning and a lot of stats, and there are natural constraints on how detailed I could go. But I did want to share in a chat a quite interesting piece of work that is public, which I think is in a crossover between the perspective around entity graphs, so free-based entities, and machine learning and embeddings. Check out the chat. It's the word to vec work.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Harold Bowley has his hand.
Yes, I have a question to Dan again. Going to your last but first slide about current challenges, you talk about data sets. So I'm wondering, you mentioned that you want to go beyond simple binary relations of RDS structured data and bring in comma-separated values as data sets, as a new data type. So how do you combine then data sets and CSV? CSV on one end with RDF on the other end.
In a second, I'll just share some links and then talk through them at the same time. So there's two pieces here. The CSV piece, I'm co-chairing with Jenny Tennyson from the Open Data Institute, the W3C group on CSV data. We gave it a really boring name, but I think it's quite an exciting group. So there's a draft just come out of that group today. We schema.org, we think that the schema.org approach, kind of lightweight RDF, it can help people find these files, CSV files, but it can also help you understand something of what's inside them. So if you imagine, for example, a CSV file where every row was a parking space in London, and there were various columns, there's a number of techniques you can use that are fairly well understood for breaking out the rows and joining them and turning them into triples. At the same time, we don't want to say that the only data that matters is triples. Sometimes finding the entire table is plenty, and you can process it as a table. So this combination of looking at the outside of the data set and sometimes looking inside as well, we think is very rich. And it seems a natural collaboration point for schema.org to pass off to W3C work in this area. The other thing to share quickly is the roles design. So anybody who's worked with RDF knows it's kind of frustrating. You always want to say more than you can say in simple unqualified triples. And the RDF data model has never had a place to annotate a property or a triple occurrence with extra information. So you've always had this awkwardness. You know, do you say Ghostbusters has an active relationship to Bill Murray? If you do that, where can you say what his character's name was? So you have to sometimes flip from a single triple into having an intermediate entity. So we've made some design choices and selected design, which is here. Any feedback on that on the W3C list or direct to me would be very much appreciated. We know it's not a perfect design. It's always painful doing this stuff in RDF. We're trying to find something that's very webmaster friendly, publisher friendly, non-ontologist person friendly, but that still gives us a basis for more expressive descriptions, for temporal qualifications.
Dan, thank you. Is there any connection between data sets and RDF named graph?
There could be, but it's not a link that we've explored. Thanks. Well, I'll share one more link, which is a Google custom search engine for finding data sets that uses schema.org. There you go. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan.
Any other questions? I don't see anyone with their hand up. There seems to be some discussion going on the chat. Amanda?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thanks. I was just starting to post, and I'll just make a side comment. You know, that Dan just posted the link to the conversation about the roles discussion that's going on public vocabs, and he mentioned public vocabs a couple times in his talk, and I just want to say sort of to the other folks on the call, from my experience as somebody, you know, I'm not directly involved, I'm not involved with schema.org in any way, but I have been lurking on public vocabs for quite some time now, and a lot of the things that Dan brought up in his talk reflect like actual conversations that I've watched go on as people try to figure out how to like meet some actual representational need and balance the needs, the expressive needs with the web developer needs, with the search engine needs, and it's been incredibly enlightening. It also, I think I have a much better understanding of, for example, sort of some of these trade-offs in between using, you know, differing things to other vocabularies versus extending schema and other trade-offs. So I just wanted to share that and both with Dan and with other folks here that I recommend lurking on public vocabs for quite a lot of enlightenment in terms of what people are doing with this stuff.
Oh, great. We've actually reached the end of this session. So I would just like to end by saying that this is really quite a great session, some fascinating talks, and an excellent discussion. There is a community input page that's available for this topic, and I would encourage everyone to contribute to that after this end of the session. And, of course, you can also continue the discussions on the mailing list. So thanks to everyone, all the speakers, all of the participants, and everyone who can make it, please come to the hackathon of your choice on Saturday.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Great session. Thank you.
Great session. Bye.